One of the most famous figures in British literary history is Sherlock Holmes, the creation of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Doyle famously tired of his creation and was most certainly not averse to other people writing adventures for his famous sleuth. Nick Utekin, editor of the Sherlock Holmes Journal, takes up the labyrinthine story of famous pastiche and parody tales concerning the Holmes figure. This is Do What You Like With Him, The Unreal Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Mr. Holmes, we've admired you in the past, as does every Englishman. Your record as our greatest detective is known throughout the world. But this, seeing how you work, knowing that there is in England such a man as you, gives us all a sense of safety and security. God bless you, Mr. Holmes.
Thank you, Dr. Mortimer. Thank you. And now, if you don't mind, I've had rather a strenuous day. I think I'll turn in.
Of course.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night, Mr. Holmes.
Good night.
Good night, sir.
Oh, Watson, the needle.
Those were the last words spoken in the 1939 film of The Hound of the Baskervilles, which launched Basil Rathbone on his career as the screen's most famous Sherlock Holmes. And what pernicious words they were. Oh, Watson, the needle. Words certainly never written by Arthur Conan Doyle. Between 1887 and 1927, Doyle wrote 56 Holmes short stories and 4 long stories, of which The Hound of the Baskervilles is the most famous. But since the early 1890s, there have been some 16,000 attempts to pastiche the Doyle style, or parody his creation, from absolutely straightforward new adventures, co-authored by Adrian Conan Doyle, Arthur's son, to the sexual adventures of Sherlock Holmes, hard gay porn. In film, on TV, by way of radio and the printed page, the characters of Holmes and Dr. Watson have been copied as no others have been in literature. The films made by Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce as his bumbling Watson in the late 1930s and early 40s are perfect examples of this treatment. Only The Hound had anything really to do with Doyle's original works. All the others were pastiches, artificial adventures written to carry the increasingly successful characters, and incidentally, to promote Sherlock as a propaganda weapon. In the middle of the Second World War, Rathbone played an updated Holmes in The Secret Weapon, fighting off Professor Moriarty and what are clearly meant to be Nazi agents from getting hold of a newly invented bomb-sighting contraption. 3 months later, in April 1943, by this time the films were being churned out on a production line, the writers decided to go the whole hog and send Holmes off to wartime Washington. The plot was quite irrelevant, but the closing sentiments weren't. They were tailored exactly for their audience of the moment and had absolutely nothing to do with Sherlock Holmes.
Well, it'll be nice to get home to Baker Street, eh, Holmes?
Yes. But this is a great country, Watson.
It certainly is, my dear fellow.
Look, up there ahead. The capital. The very heart of this democracy.
Democracy? The only hope for the future, eh, Holmes?
It's not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. But in the days to come, the British and American people will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
That's magnificent. I quite agree with you.
Not with me. With Mr. Winston Churchill. I was quoting from the speech he made not so long ago. In that very building.
It's a measure of the impact that Conan Doyle's creation had that within a year of his first appearance in short story form, A Scandal in Bohemia, in the Strand magazine for July 1891, he was being parodied as Sherlock Holmes in Jerome K. Jerome's publication The Idler. Over the years, the names became stranger and, presumably, their authors thought funnier. Hemlock Jones, Holmlock Shears, Creplock Holes, Morlock Tomes, and Sherbert Cones, not to mention Herlock Sholmes, Padlock Jones, and God Save Us, Potluck Bones. The names are often noticeably funnier, if that is the word, than the stories that followed. Why should Sherlock Holmes have turned out to be the fictional character more parodied and more interestingly rewritten in pastiche form than any other? If you've edited a journal like the Sherlock Holmes Journal, devoted to someone who never lived, for as long as I have, nearly 25 years, then you can quickly come up with nerdish answers to that question. He's a larger-than-life creation, hugely popular, iconically recognisable, apparently quite easy to copy stylistically, and there's a seemingly insatiable demand from publishers for more and more. On the other hand, you could say that the creator himself gave the green light to would-be pastiche writers before the turn of the 20th century. A famous American matinee idol, William Gillette, saw Holmes's stage potential and began work on a play, with Conan Doyle's permission and initially partial collaboration. Now, matinee idols are matinee idols, but then Sherlock Holmes is Sherlock Holmes, and when Gillette wanted to bring in a love interest, he was distinctly worried about so doing. "May I marry Holmes?" he wrote to Doyle. By then, Holmes, in Conan Doyle's eyes, was already long dead, famously killed off at the Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland in 1892, and Doyle couldn't have cared less. "You may marry him, or murder him, or do what you like with him," was his peremptory and rather heartless reply. And Gillette did. Well, Holmes was embracing the heroine when the curtain fell. The play, Sherlock Holmes, was a huge hit when it opened in 1899, and Gillette was still touring it in the mid-1930s. He also made a film of it in 1916, but no known copy exists. And until the play was resuscitated by the Royal Shakespeare Company in the early 1970s in London's West End and then on Broadway, it was left to a famous radio practitioner to have his way with Gillette's words.
The Columbia Broadcasting System takes pleasure in bringing you the 12th in its series of weekly broadcasts featuring Orson Welles and the Mercury Theatre on the air. Tonight, Broadway's and radio's most celebrated theatrical producing company brings to life the best-loved character in detective fiction, the immortal Sherlock Holmes. The play is Orson Welles' own adaptation for radio of William Gillette's enduring melodrama based on the famous stories by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Before the performance begins...
Live on the evening of Sunday, the 25th of September, 1938, Orson Welles paid gracious tribute.
It is too little to say that William Gillette resembled Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes looks exactly like William Gillette. Sounds like him, too, we're afraid, and hope devoutly that the Mercury Theatre and the radio will take none of the glamour from the beloved fable of Baker Street, from the pipe and the violin and the hideous purple dressing gown, from the needle and the cigar on the window ledge, and the dry, final, famous lines. Elementary, my dear Watson, elementary. The mere child's play of deduction.
No one quite knows for certain, but it may be that we have here a hint of the origin of that phrase most closely connected in the popular mind to Sherlock Holmes. Conan Doyle made him say elementary on a number of occasions, and the phrase, my dear Watson, occurs with metronomic regularity, but never together on the printed page. Actually, why not let Gillette himself have his own way with his own words? Exhaustive detective research, worthy of at least potluck bones, reveals that the genuine voice of William Gillette in his greatest role hasn't previously been broadcast on BBC Radio or possibly radio anywhere. In 1936, a Boston professor, Francis Clifton Packard, who very sensibly had a hobby of recording any famous voice that passed through town, caught up with the actor when touring, invited him to his own living room, and then got him to record on a glass cylinder 9 minutes of readings from the Sherlock Holmes play, with Packard himself reading Watson and his wife Alice as the play's heroine, Alice Faulkner. Ardent American Sherlockians made the recording available on cassette in 1987, and this is the cleaned-up version.
Because by now you must begin to realize the trick and the deception I've practiced on you in order to make you give up your property. I couldn't take it out of the house that first night like a straightforward thief, because it could have been recovered at law. And for that reason, I swindled you out of it.
Swindled me?
Precisely. That's just what I did. Swindled you out of it. Now that you know this, Miss Faulkner, and now that you realize what sort of a person I am, it must be sufficient to make you turn away from me with loathing and disgust.
But it isn't sufficient.
Yes, well, I'm sorry, but I must be going. I suppose Mademoiselle is waiting to take you home.
But, Mr. Holmes...
Yes?
I want to ask you something.
Oh, Certainly. What is it?
Don't you care for me at all?
It can make no difference whatever whether I do or not.
It can make a great deal of difference to me.
Miss Faulkner.
Yes?
This is a trying situation, isn't it? Of course, we must find some way out of it.
But I don't want any way out of it.
Do you remember that you asked me a question just now? Well, this is the answer. I do care for you, I do. But I'm not telling you anything. You knew it perfectly well before.
But I think it's just as well for you to say it.
Well, I do say it. But, dearest one, that must be the end of it. The end of it.
Pastiche, as the dictionary has it, a literary or other work of art composed in the style of a well-known writer or artist, should be a form of homage to the original. When the RSC revival of Sherlock Holmes was riding high in London's Aldwych Theatre, and an American writer called Nicholas Meyer had produced a hugely successful latter-day Holmes adventure called The 7% Solution at about the same time, I thought I'd have a go. I knew my Sherlock, a work colleague knew how to construct plots, and we co-wrote two published pastiches, nakedly jumping on the bandwagon. I look back on them with guilt. They were barely adequate. Reviewers at the time were ruder, and they should probably not have been inflicted on an audience eager for new adventures of the master and his Boswell. You think it's so easy, because Doyle's style seems so easy. Put Holmes, Watson, landlady Mrs. Hudson, a dim Scotland Yarder, and a couple of self-invented but representative characters into a plot, turn the key, and set the parts moving. And if you can involve Professor Moriarty as well, so much the better. How trite.
Oh, Dr. Watson, thank heavens you've come. I'm at my wit's end.
Why? What has happened?
These last few months since you've left us, he's become very strange. He's got himself barricaded in up there, won't take his meals, keeps the shutters closed all day, and then steals out at night. Dr. Watson, I think he's taking...
Mrs. Hudson, I hear there's someone down there with you. I heard the cab stop before the door. If that gentleman answers to the name Moriarty, you may show him up, and I will deal with him.
I'd better go to him.
Be careful.
I mounted the 17 well-trod steps with a heavy heart. What a noble mind was here overthrown.
Moriarty, is that you?
It is I, Watson.
Watson?
You see, it is I, Holmes. Let me enter.
Not so fast. You may be Moriarty in disguise. Prove you are Watson.
Oh, how on earth am I to do that?
Tell me where I keep my tobacco.
Simon Callow as a manic Holmes, with Ian Hogg as Watson in a 1993 Radio 4 adaptation of The 7% Solution. The conceit of this pastiche was Holmes coming to grips with a central psychological problem, the nature of the Moriarty figure in his life, and consulting Sigmund Freud. This is another pit into which Holmesian pastiche writers have leapt headlong over the years, bringing real figures to the Baker Street hearth. Conan Doyle was far too sensible to involve Mr. Gladstone or Sir Arthur Sullivan in his fiction, but it seemed that every pastiche bandwagon jumper in the 1970s and 80s loaded 221B with people from the pages of true history, presumably hoping to surprise or impress the reader, rather than sticking to the business of accurate mystery writing and character creation. Theodore Roosevelt, Bram Stoker, Harry Houdini, and Aleister Crowley spring to mind. And didn't my co-author and I, in 1976, think we were clever when we inserted Baron von Richthofen, a young Winston Churchill, and a Corporal Schickelgruber into our couple of efforts? And then there's always Saucy Jack.
My dear Mycroft, this is a surprise. Watson, some sherry. I expected you round last week to consult me about the Manor House case. I thought you might be a little bit out of your depth.
No, I solved it.
It was Adams, of course.
Yes, it was Adams.
Yes, I knew that from the start. Thank you.
Mycroft, is this a social call?
Oh, yes, purely social, yes. How are you?
Very well. Well, now that the social call is over, hadn't we better get down to business?
Ah, I perceive you've come from the Prime Minister. Why, Sherlock?
It is still forenoon, but you are not at your desk. You're dressed for Buckingham Palace, but the Queen is at Balmoral Castle, and you've already wasted a great deal of time in idle chatter, so obviously your mission is urgent. Now, what does the Prime Minister want?
To ask you in confidence, of course, to bring the Whitechapel murderer to justice before he brings down the government.
No, but your brother has... government which allows the poverty of Whitechapel deserves, as far as I'm concerned, riddance. Nor will I become engaged in political manoeuvres.
John Neville as Holmes, Robert Morley as Brother Mycroft, and a squeak from a miscast Donald Houston as Watson in a scene from the 1965 film A Study in Terror, only one of several film and book attempts to connect the great fictional detective with the great undiscovered prostitute killer Jack the Ripper. Well, why not? They coexisted in the London of the late 1880s, and Conan Doyle unaccountably never had them cross swords. Crime writer Michael Dibdin first dipped his toe into this genre in 1978 with the last Sherlock Holmes story, which had Holmes himself revealed as the Ripper. And a year later, a thoroughly satisfying film called Murder by Decree put Christopher Plummer and James Mason in one of his last roles, together as Holmes and Watson, using to good effect some solid historical research that made a Masonic link to the Whitechapel murders. But there was time for humour as well.
Last night, when we were examining the body of the unfortunate Catherine Ashes...
Oh, don't remind me of that, old chap.
Do you notice a woman in the crowd?
I notice dozens of women.
Well, yes, I would expect that of you, Watson. But one particular woman. Watson.
Yes.
Watson, what are you doing?
I'm trying to corner the last pea on my plate. What's that object you're fooling around with?
Well, nothing. Yet.
Yeah.
But, as I was saying, about the woman.
I don't know how you can worry about some woman in a crowd when you're supposed to be conducting an investigation.
But there was a singularly haunting quality about her. Like some wild creature cornered. Now you've got a corner.
Yeah, but squashing a fellow's pee.
One of the major problems for pastiche writers and filmmakers is that there is a public perception of this extraordinary character of Sherlock Holmes. A lot of boys and girls aged around 13 or 14 encounter the original stories, and if they're remotely interested, the image is set. It's probably still Basil Rathbone, or for more recent generations, Jeremy Brett. The film director and screenwriter Billy Wilder, exactly 30 years ago, decided to break the mould with an original set of stories and a languid and nearly foppish Holmes in the person of Robert Stevens. If there is such a thing as a typical Billy Wilder film, he of Double Indemnity, Sunset Boulevard, Some Like It Hot and The Apartment, the private life of Sherlock Holmes is emphatically not it. We'll probably never know exactly what Wilder intended, since the film's distributors panicked after a tryout showing and ordered massive cuts. Two full plot elements were dropped, but not before some fascinating publicity photos were taken of a very young Sherlock rowing for his college and Holmes and Watson walking into an upside-down room. What remains, however, is an elegiac and very personal celebration, to my mind the best screen pastiche of Holmes, with a neat juxtaposition of Holmes as action man, dealing with Victorian submarines in Loch Ness, and Holmes the romantic. Stevens was the first Sherlock since William Gillett to fall in love. In a Radio 2 interview, broadcast in March 1988, Stevens remembered discussing with Billy Wilder how he should approach playing the character.
I said, would you like me to do any background work on Sherlock Holmes? He said, well, yes, you can read all the stories if you want to. He said, but it takes a very long time. I said, as the film was basically comic, except for the end when the sad bit comes in, he said, play it as if you were playing Hamlet. He said, you must play it absolutely seriously. I will make it funny. Don't ever try to be funny. And don't try to tip the wink on anything. He said, also, you must look like a pencil, so you must be about 12 stone one, which is very thin. He said, and learn to play the violin. I said, well, I can't possibly live your life down. He said, well, you just learn to handle it, so you don't handle it like a cricket bat. But it was his concept of Sherlock Holmes. And I thought a very delightful and affectionate one.
And Stevens, not surprisingly, lamented the slashing of the film.
It took them 7 years to write it. It took 29 weeks to shoot all of it. God knows what it cost. I believe in America there is the original version around somewhere.
I was going to ask
you. I would love to see it. Because I think, especially for Colin Blakely, who had much more to do in the other two cases, and he was a brilliant when he tries to solve the case himself, using all my methods, and of course makes a complete mess of it all. So it was like Colin's episode, in which he said, you mustn't give me any advice or say anything. So I only say, yes, very good, quite right. So he emulates, using all my manner of being Sherlock Holmes, all gone. I thought it was very sad. But it was good, it was the greatest fun to do. But what was interesting on the film was that Billy would stand behind the camera, naturally, to watch the take. And Izzy Diamond would stand behind him with the script, like a prompter.
Mm-hmm. So you would, because they collaborated on the script.
Absolutely, yes. Well, many and various films. So you would do it, and it would be correct for everyone. So very good, Mark, it's all right for you. Yes, fine for him, blah, blah, blah. He would then say, Izzy, were all the words there? And he would say, well, he actually cut that little bit. Let's do it again. It had to be absolutely as written. And Irene Handel, who was a writer and a very fine actress, being Mrs. Hudson, said, oh, she wouldn't say that, and I know these old landladies. And he said, I know, you know, but just say what's written. I know maybe you could write it much better, but, you know, it's... Our scripts, you just say.
Robert Stevens interviewed by Marjorie Bilbo for Star Sound Cinema on Radio 2. The question now has to be asked, what's the point of doing a new written pastiche of Holmes? Why bother? The original corpus of material is there for all to enjoy. The Holmes stories have never been out of print, of course. So why fiddle around? There are plenty of Sherlock Holmes purists who say exactly that. But then those purists will know that there are several Conan Doyle originals that are dire. Look at The Three Gables or The Veiled Lodger. By the time Doyle was writing these in the 20s, he was being paid a fortune by American publishers. Reports of a dollar a word are probably not far off the mark. He couldn't care less about the character by then. He needed money to help fund his spiritualist propagandizing. Some pastiches are far better than those originals. The American writer Vincent Starrett set the standard in the 1930s with The Adventure of the Unique Hamlet, which was utterly true to Doyle's style and utterly satisfying. Much more recently, British crime writer June Thompson has got the concept of the Sherlock Holmes short story down to a fine art, and I, for one, would far rather read one of her adventures than plough through Doyle's The Mazarin Stone. Over the years, one or two classic writers have had a go at Sherlock. In 1978, Kingsley Amis played with a rigidly straight bat when he wrote a short story called The Darkwater Hall Mystery. On consulting my notes, their paper grown yellow and their ink brown with the passage of almost 40 years, I find it to have been in the closing days of July 1885 that my friend Sherlock Holmes fell victim, more completely perhaps than at any other time, to the innate melancholy of his temperament. And so on. Could Doyle himself have started off in better form? And maybe Doyle the originator might himself have chosen, if he'd been writing during the late 1970s, to publish his new home stories where Amis did, in Playboy magazine. Again in the 70s, John Gardner promised a trilogy of novels concentrating on Professor Moriarty, but to date has only provided two-thirds of the total, and Isaac Asimov flirted with the concept 20 years ago. Decades earlier, Mark Twain was rather amused at the casual manner in which Conan Doyle had killed off Holmes in one book and brought him back in the next. Doyle resuscitated Holmes from the Reichenbach Falls and the Hound of the Baskervilles in the pages of the Strand magazine of August 1901, and Mark Twain took the mickey only 5 months later in a parody called A Double-Barreled Detective Story. In 1903, in Punch, P.G. Wodehouse had his bite from the eternally productive cherry.
Dudley Jones was a man who devoted his best energy to the extinction of bores. With a clear-sightedness which few modern philanthropists possess, he recognised that though society had many enemies, none was so deadly as the bore. Burglars, indeed, Jones regarded with disapproval, and I have known him to be positively rude to a man who confessed in the course of conversation to being a forger. But his real foes were the Boers, and all that one man could do to eliminate that noxious tribe, that did Dudley Jones do with all his might. Of all his cases, none seems to me so fraught with importance as the adventure of the unwelcome guest. It was, as Jones remarked at intervals of 10 minutes, a black business. This guest... But I will begin at the beginning. We were standing at the window of our sitting room in Grocer Square one morning when a new broom swept clean up to our door. We heard the bell ring and footsteps ascending the stairs. There was a knock. "Come in," said Jones, and our visitor entered.
"My name is Miss Pettigrew,"
she observed, by way of breaking the ice. "Please take a seat," said Jones in his smooth professional accents. "This is my friend Waddis. I generally allow him to remain during my consultations. You see, he makes himself useful in a lot of little ways, taking notes and so on. And then, if we turned him out, he would only listen at the keyhole. You follow me, I trust? Waddis, go and lie down on the mat. Now, Miss Pettigrew, if you please."
"Mine,"
began Miss Pettigrew,
"is a very painful case."
"And they all are," said Jones.
"I was recommended to come to you by a Mrs. Edward Noodle. She said that you had helped her husband in a great crisis."
"Waddis," said Jones, who to all appearances was half asleep, "fetch my scrapbook." The press cutting relating to Mr. Edward Noodle was sandwiched between a statement that Mr. Balfour never eats doughnuts and a short essay on the treatment of thrush in infants.
"Ah," said Jones, "I remember the case now. It was out of my usual line, being simply a case of theft. Mr. Noodle was wrongfully accused of purloining a needle."
"I remember," I said eagerly. "The case for the prosecution was that Neddy Noodle nipped his neighbour's needle."
That was Crawford Logan reading from Woodhouse's parody Dudley Jones, Boar Hunter, on Radio 4 in 1993. If the pipe and the deerstalker are the obvious visual images associated with Holmes, his violin playing and general appreciation of music come very close as essential elements in the cosy Baker Street picture, so no surprise that he's been celebrated in musical pastiche.
"Sit down, my dear Captain Gregg. Or is it Lieutenant?"
"Captain? Lieutenant? What makes you think I'm in the army at all, for that matter?"
"Come, come. Your profession isn't hard to perceive. Your manner, your bearing, the very clothes you're wearing, that handkerchief tucked in your sleeve. A military custom, I believe. Of course you're an officer. Sandhurst, am I right? And you're too young for a major, and so I should gauge you're a captain."
"Well, I'll be..."
"Quite."
"Sir, I'm amazed."
"You show surprise, and yet the facts are there before your very eyes. And it's so simple, sublimely simple. If you learn not just to see, but to observe, put your brain to work, not just the optic nerve. If you put your mind to use, you will find the most abstruse become so simple.
Oh, yes, so simple. Just as simple as a simple thing can be.
And it's hardly very hard to see he's in the palace guard.
Oh, no, it's simple as ABC.
Fritz Weaver singing the part of Holmes in the smash hit 1965 Broadway musical Baker Street, A Musical Adventure of Sherlock Holmes, written by Jerome Coopersmith. And Leslie Bricus, a name to be conjured with in British musicals, tried the same sort of thing more than two decades later in Sherlock Holmes the Musical, with Ron Moody and Derek Waring in the lead roles.
"The truth is, I am bored, Watson." "Oh, nonsense, Holmes. Your genius for solving the unsolvable is legendary. I mean, you're speaking of the man who solved the Boscombe Valley mystery."
"Well, that's history."
"And the scandal in Bohemia."
"Than which nothing could be seemier."
"And the red-headed league."
"A pathetic intrigue."
"The man who solved the riddle of the engineer's thumb."
"A mere memory makes me numb."
"The solitary cyclist."
"Is on my do-not-like list."
"The yellow face."
"A dreary case."
"The sign of four."
"God, what a bore."
"The crooked man."
"A puny plan."
"Wisteria Lodge."
"A dismal dodge."
"Well, what about the adventure of the dying detective. Now, there, old friend, perhaps you're getting slightly more selective.
In the case of Lady Carfax.
That did have some bizarre facts.
The Abbey Grange.
Yes, that was strange.
Black Peter and the Naval Treaty, too.
I must confess, dear Watson, the simplistic list of plots on which you base my reputation proves it's true. What is that I am actually missing, Professor James Moriarty?
You're missing that fiend Moriarty.
A musical which opened and abruptly closed in London's West End in 1989. Some of the reviews probably didn't help. Has the once prolific Mr. Leslie Bricusse set foot in a musical theatre since Lionel Bart wrote Oliver? And if so, why did he fall asleep? And Ron Moody's Holmes makes one long for another Reichenbach Falls into which he can be pushed. Actually, parodying Sherlock Holmes is rather easier than the pastiche form, which should call for at least some basic ability to recreate Conan Doyle's writing and plotting styles. Parody simply demands a funny name and a funny take on the original. Some have taken it seriously and have succeeded hysterically. The Sherlock Holmes series by Robert L. Fish, most of which made their first appearances in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine in the 1960s and 70s, are a case in point, but sadly, no one has bothered dramatising or recording them. Others have had a go, well, because they were extremely famous and could have a go, despite no background knowledge at all. Here's the creator of Shamrock Wolmes and Doctored Whopper, discussing his approach to parody in a 1965 radio interview.
You know, these little pieces in the book, they give an appearance of great finish, perfection. Do you revise them? Yes? No, and they're not, they don't look all that spontaneous. They look as though they've been worked over. Do you work them
they're
over?
They're not at all. Nobody's ever said that. It's simply wonderful. They are spontaneous, and I hardly ever alter anything, because I'm selfish about what I write, or big-headed about it. Once I've written it, I like it. And the publisher sometimes says, you know, should we leave this out or change that? And I fight like mad, because once I've done it, I like to keep it. But I always write it straight off. I might add things when I go over it before it's published, but I'd seldom take anything out. So no, it is spontaneous.
The puns all the other technical things, the puns, the onomatopoeia, the changing...
What?
That's a long word. I tell you, onomatopoeia is, you know, when... Like,
that's three words, the word of the day.
You know, when I say a word like buzz, buzz is an onomatopoeia because it's in the word, is captured the noise of the bee. That's onomatopoeia, and you probably without realizing that. Your book is full of them. You know what I mean?
Is it? Well, I'm glad to know that. Lots of onomatopoeias.
Well, you'd rather answer my question, because I was going to ask you whether these were contrived with all the...
No, I've just not a clue what you're talking about, really. Automatic peer sounds like to me. That's probably why I'd change words, because I haven't a clue what words mean all the time.
So this is a natural facility, really?
Yes, it's a sort of native talent, you'd call it, I think.
Do the other boys give you ideas? Do they throw in ideas?
Yes, we were on holiday in Tahiti. George, I went with George, and I was writing The Single Large Experience of Miss Anne Duffield, and it was the longest one I'd ever done. That was like a discipline. I was seeing how far I could go, because I always get fed up.
That's the Sherlock Holmes take.
Sherlock Holmes, yeah. And I wanted to see if I could carry on and on. I would have gone on and on and made a whole book out of it if I could, but I couldn't. That was as far as... Well, with that, I'd get to some word, I'd get a sentence, and it just didn't work somehow. So I'd say to George, have you got... What's another word for fly? And he'd suggest something.
That little piece, to me anyway, showed quite a lot of...
That's me big piece.
That's your big piece, I think. That big piece showed very close acquaintanceship with the work of Conan Doyle. Do you read his books? I mean, you know them?
No, I'd read one or two when I was younger, but on this boat that we hired, there was a set of books, half of them were in French and half of them were in English. Well, just lying about in the sun gets a bit boring. Well, it does for, you know, I'm sorry about those people who don't lie about in the sun, but, so I just read every book on the that was in English, whether I liked it or not, just through boredom, really. And there just happened to be a big volume of Sherlock Holmes. And that was, you know, I'm not mad on it because it's sort of one. They're all pretty similar. That's what I was doing, really, writing all of them into one. They're all different short stories of Sherlock Holmes, and they seemed all almost the same to me.
John Lennon, keeping cool in the face of seriously patronising questions, by Wilfred Dayath on the Home Service almost exactly 35 years ago, on July the 3rd, 1965. He'd written The Singularge Experience of Miss Anne Duffield in his second book of witticisms, A Spaniard in the Works. Some items defy accurate description. Is this parody or pastiche, a combination of the two, or just a straightforward after-dinner tour de force? Of the amazing 150 or so groups in the United States devoted to the study of Sherlock Holmes, the most important is the Baker Street Irregulars, founded by two now nearly forgotten American men of letters in the 1930s, Christopher Morley and Vincent Starrett. The organisation effectively exists to have an annual dinner, at which members are asked to read a paper or perform in some other way. Again, from the 1960s, another previously unbroadcast piece of whimsy, this time Sherlockian Herb Breen, performing before a postprandial audience, his idea of how a publisher would have dealt with a telephone call from Arthur Conan Doyle, representing his own client Dr. Watson, and trying to sell the very first of the Sherlock Holmes stories, A Study in Scarlet.
Tell me what it's about, anyway. Come on. A man named Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock, yeah, all right. No, that's all right. It's as good a name as any. What does Mr. Holmes do? He's a private consultant. Another doctor. Oh, he's not.
Carl Schell.
What's... He makes deductions. Oh, look, Doyle, I know you're a stranger to our shores, but this is the income tax period. Everybody's making deductions. This is not new.
A couple of minutes later, he really gets into his stride.
In this story, who does the dirty work? You know, or whatever, you might... Oh, some Mormons. Oh, well, you're some. No, I wouldn't even try to explain this to an Englishman. I'm sorry, but I wouldn't. But, do you have anything else? The sign of the four. I say, oh, all right. I know I shouldn't ask, but who are the four? Most of them are Indians. Well, look, I will explain it. I'll have to. You see, you're dealing entirely with minority groups. In this country, you just cannot have a villain who's a member of a minority group. I mean, first you're picking on a religious group. Now, then you go into an ethnic group. The country's segregation conscious today, Doyle. I'm sorry, but... Tell your client, what's his name, Dr. Watson, to make the villains white, Protestant, males, and with simple names like Smith or Jones or something like that. You know, I mean, don't... No, I'd lay off Moriarty. The Irish are still very sensitive.
Baker Street Irregular, Herb Breen. Television comedy commissioning editors over here in the 1970s thought only of one person as a funny Sherlock Holmes. John Cleese was that man, and both the BBC and ITV provided him with classic Watson figures. For the Corporation, in a Comedy Playhouse production in January 1973, it was Willie Rushton.
These deviled kidneys are uncommonly appetizing, Holmes.
A speciality of Mrs. Hudson's, Watson, homegrown by that very good lady herself, and she is not a little proud of them, as you will discover for yourself when she comes through that door in precisely 2 seconds from now to see whether we have finished our meal.
I fear it's going to be one of those days, Holmes.
One of those days, Watson? To what are you referring? Why is your plate still on the table in front of you? Has Mrs. Hudson not been in to clear it away?
No, she has not, Holmes, no.
Ah, I must be losing my touch, Watson.
Expected, Holmes, that you'd retain powers as exceptional as yours indefinitely. They're bound to wane with the passing of the years.
And yet you remain as staunch a friend and ally as ever.
Well, the situation is an excellent one. It enables me to neglect my practice almost totally in order to go off on these wild, harebrained jaunts with you, and at the same time still live extremely comfortably.
It may well be, Watson, that you will be accompanying me on yet another, and in the very immediate future. Read that.
Elementary, my dear Watson, in 1973. 4 years on, for ITV this time, Cleese played the same role, this time with Arthur Lowe as Watson.
Oh. Hello, Watson. Holmes. He's taken a turn for the worse, I'm afraid. Terribly ill. In fact, he's so desperately ill, he's dead.
The knife was removed and then reinserted in an attempt to stop the hemorrhaging caused by its removal. A second insertion, the cause of death.
Good Lord. How do you know that?
I was watching you, you bird. I could not believe my eyes. I have to work with this. I mean, I leave you here for 20 seconds with the top policeman in Britain and you kill him!
John Cleese in The Strange Case of the End of Civilization as We Know It, from 1977. A year on, one of the most grotesque parodies in the history of film was launched on a public that quickly rejected it. Peter Cook and Dudley Moore decided it would be tremendously funny to send up The Hound of the Baskervilles.
I don't know where you bought this, Holmes. I don't know where I'm going to hang it in Baker Street.
Exactly, Watson. A perfect likeness of the Hound of the Baskervilles, painted by the late Sir Charles and hung upside down by Glynnis, who used to work in the hall and, as you know, gets everything backwards.
Exactly. So, that means that Sir Charles actually saw the hound and painted it before his death.
Yes, I think he did paint it before his death, Watson. I don't think he painted it afterwards.
Exactly. So that means there is actually a huge, horrible hound out there on the moors.
Precisely.
Well, we can't possibly let Sir Henry go out there and have dinner with Beryl tonight.
On the contrary, you and Sir Henry will dine at Merripit Hall as planned.
No, Holmes, he's back up it.
Calm yourself, Watson, it's only a painting.
I am calm and I...
And it's only sad that they drew into that farrago actors of the quality of Denham Elliot and Joan Greenwood. A decade later came a far more clever cinema parody. The gimmick of Without a Clue is that it was Watson who had the real brains of the outfit and hired a failed alcoholic actor to personify the Holmes that the reading public now expected.
How can I be... How can I be expected to maintain a character when you belittle me in front of those hooligans?
Character? Are we talking of the same man who once declared with total conviction that the late Colonel Howard had been bludgeoned to death by a blunt excrement?
Is it my fault if you have such poor handwriting? Anyway, it was just a little mistake.
He's been at it again.
I never liked that woman. Come in, Mrs. Hudson.
I found it under a loose board in the stairwell.
Thank you, Mrs. Hudson. An occasional libation enables me to stiffen my resolve.
Your resolve should be pickled by now.
I don't believe that either of you realize what pressure I'm under. You know what it's like to commit to memory a never-ending list of clues and deductions to be parroted back to Lestrade and reporters? Bloodstains on the toothpick, cigar ash, new soil in the garden next door. Endless twaddle! Twaddle!
An outraged Michael Caine as a deutero Holmes. His whole performance is quite outrageous. With Ben Kingsley as Watson in the 1988 film Without a Clue. How much more complicated can the genre become? Watson, already a fictitious character, creating his own fictitious character of Sherlock Holmes, who then complains about what's expected of him. Well, I suppose you could ask Watson to talk to a radio announcer.
Send for your free recipe calendar tonight. Just send your name and address to Petri Wine. P-E-T-R-I, Petri Wine, San Francisco, 26, California. And now for our weekly visit with the good Dr. Watson. Let's see if he's waiting for us.
Come in. Come in. Good evening, Mr. Forrest.
Oh, good evening, Doctor. Playing the phonograph, I see.
Yes, my boy. And that particular melody has some very potent memories for me. Here, I'll turn the thing off. You haven't come here to listen to a Mozart sonata. You want a story, don't you, young fellow, my lad?
That's right, Doctor.
Well, let's sit down.
All right.
That's better. Now I'll tell you one.
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
Began in Vienna in 1889, many, many years before the insane house painter named Schickelgruber had converted that gay city into a place of fear and oppression.
Corporal Schickelgruber again. That was Nigel Bruce as Watson, bantering with his announcer after a word from our sponsor, in the Viennese Strangler. Bruce and Basil Rathbone built on their hugely successful film partnership as Holmes and Watson with no fewer than 213 half-hour radio dramas, which went out live from Hollywood from 1939 until 1946, broadcast on the CBS network. Early on, they stuck to the originals, but their producers' nerves broke on November the 2nd, 1941, with The Case of the Walking Corpse, followed 3 weeks later by The Hindu in the Wicker Basket. Responsible for many of these new adventures, who can forget The Haunted Bagpipes, The Vampire of Cadiz, or The Man Who Drowned in Paddington Station? With a crime writer, Anthony Boucher, and a man credited as Bruce Taylor, but better known as Leslie Charteris, creator of The Saint. A few years ago, I interviewed Nigel Bruce's daughter, Pauline Page, for a piece in the Sherlock Holmes Journal. As a young teenager in Hollywood, how did she remember Basil Rathbone?
Basil Rathbone had been a friend of my father and my mother, who'd been an actress on the English stage, for some time before. Basil, Uncle Basil, I call him, went to Hollywood before my family and myself. We all went. And then they used to meet at various parties, socially. Ouida Rathbone gave fantastic parties, was always entertaining, and my mother and they all got on very well. And then, of course, after the Sherlock Holmes started, I mean, they practically lived in one another's pockets, I'm glad to say.
What was Basil Rathbone like, or how did he strike you as an impressionable teenager in those Hollywood days?
He struck me as the most wonderful, kind, loving, gentle, really gentle man, with not a nasty streak in his body. He had a very ambitious, rather pushy little wife who gave these wonderful parties. But Basil was always there. He could be slightly hammy, he could be slightly dramatic, but he was a very extremely good, kind and thoughtful person. And I remember, as I grew up, he would just write me letters or treat me as a grown-up, never talk down to me. And he was my really loved and adored Uncle Basil.
Now, along came the Sherlock Holmes films and the pairing of your father with Basil Rathbone as the immortal duo. Did you ever go and watch the filming of any of the films, either of the 20th Century Fox or the Universal films?
Yes, I obviously went down on innumerable occasions. I can't actually remember a specific one, but I do remember once going to, I believe it was The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, one of the first 20th Century Fox 2. And I don't remember anything really very much, except how eerie and spooky and real that set was, and how right it always was in black and white anyway. And I just remember Basil and Daddy looking very strange and very new in those days, because we hadn't got used to their costumes. And as a child of about 11 or 12, as I suppose I was then, it all seemed very strange, it all seemed very nice, and it all seemed very exciting. And if we went as visitors on the set, all the grips, the electricians, mechanics, the director, you know, all the people who were around were always frightfully kind to us as little girls, and we were given a royal welcome, and it used to be one of the greatest treats we could have.
It has to be said that most actors who've played Watson since Nigel Bruce have struggled desperately to pull their performances as far as possible away from his buffoonish creation, Bubus Britannicus, he was once called unkindly, but accurately. I asked Pauline Page if that had been her father's own idea.
I think he played the character largely the way he was in real life, in some ways, although in real life he was an exceedingly intelligent man, used to read at least a book a day, have high, well, rather too many arguments on politics and get involved in all these sort of things. But I think that the comedy side of him took over as a sort of foil to the seriousness of Sherlock Holmes. And, of course, as time went by and some of the stories became a bit more impossible and not the genuine Conan Doyle stories, they did get a little bit bored with their parts. They did intend to overdo things. My father did increase the buffoonery and not only made himself laugh and Basil laugh, sometimes in the wrong places, but also was very much identified with the comedy part of it. And sometimes, I mean, he certainly did overdo it.
A far more plausible Watson was the Watson for British television viewers in the late 1960s, Nigel Stock, who played the role opposite Douglas Wilmer and Peter Cushing in two series of authentic adaptations. Years later, Stock took to the boards in a one-handed play written especially for him by Martin Reed. 221B was a clever and ruminative piece, with Watson returning to Baker Street after Holmes's apparent death at the Reichenbach Falls and basically reminiscing.
My old armchair. Good to see you in your old place again, Watson. Unexpectedly available. Unexpected indeed. And most unwelcome. Damned Alps. Obituaries. Yes. Mr. Sherlock Holmes. It must now be considered to be beyond doubt that the tragic events which we recently reported as having taken place at the spectacular waterfalls at Reichenbach in the Swiss Alps resulted not only in the disappearance and death of Professor Moriarty of evil memory, but also of his long-time antagonist, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the consulting detective. Dr. John H. Watson, Mr. Holmes's colleague and biographer, and friend. I like to think friend. Said he would continue to hope, despite all the conclusive evidence to the contrary, and quoted a favorite maxim of Holmes's. When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. We wish we could share the good doctor's sanguinity.
Nigel Stock as Dr. Watson in 221B. That dramatisation was broadcast as a Radio 4 afternoon play in October 1986 to commemorate the actor's death earlier that year. Again, how much more complex can the Sherlockian puzzle become? Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's creation, reading Martin Reed's words, purporting to be a newspaper obituary of Sir Arthur's other creation, Sherlock Holmes. And perhaps it sums up the unreal world inhabited by Holmes 70 years after Doyle's death. You simply can't eliminate him. It's impossible. Recently, a writer placed him on the Titanic. Not so long ago, he was investigating, in another book, President Kennedy's assassination. And I'm afraid there simply wasn't enough time to play an extract from Disney's Basil the Great Mouse Detective, which picked on the lovely idea in some children's books that there was a mouse living behind the woodwork at 221B Baker Street who watched, listened, and learned. There is a personal tragic coda I have to report. A Scottish minister of my acquaintance moonlighted from his pulpit on occasion as a computer detective, checking if an alleged statement to the police was really the work of the accused, or breaking down the words used in St. Paul's epistles to see if he was the author of them all. He found me out. I gave him an extract from one of Conan Doyle's real home stories, a piece that I'd written in Doyle's style in one of those rather poor pastiches, and a burst of descriptive prose by me as me, looking only at the usage of the phrases of thee, on thee, and to thee, he proved conclusively that my style as Doyle was nothing like Doyle's style as Doyle. But whether or not the style is easy to copy, hundreds have tried it. No one's ever really attempted to do the same to Oliver Twist, or Robinson Crusoe, or Don Quixote, or any of the other enduring characters from the pages of fiction with whom Sherlock Holmes has been compared. The original creation by Conan Doyle stands firm 70 years on, but the lightness of touch in that creation was clever enough to let a lot of people have a lot of fun. In the end, the appeal is best summarised in poem form by the American writer Vincent Starrett, who wrote in 1942, "A yellow fog swirls past the window pane as night descends upon this fabled street. A lonely hansom splashes through the rain. The ghostly gas lamps fail at 20 feet. Here, though the world explode, these two survive. And it is always 1895.
With regard to Sherlock Holmes, I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor, and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought, especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh.
What do you really want, Mr. Sherlock Holmes?
Herr Heinrich Henkel, in 1914, secret agent of the German Kaiser. Since then, head of the most insidious international spy ring that ever existed.
You're wrong. A case of mistaken identity.
Wonderful story, by the way, but on page 2...
A writer must write of which he knows.
Oh, do you think that's really necessary? I mean, tarnishing the image and all that? Hello? What have we here?
Do What You Like With Him, The Unreal Life of Sherlock Holmes, was written and presented by Nick Utekin and was produced by Ian Doherty.